Iku iluna, please rise.
Auhea oko eko ka aha. Inahe kuliana imua okea aha ho kolo kolo ki e ki e hanohano oka moku aina o Hawaii. E nau mai, e malio mai, ilohi ia kaleo.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. E noho ilalo. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 2689, State of Hawaii versus Chance Hirata. Arguing for the petitioner, Chance Hirata, Haley Chang, Deputy Public Defender. Arguing for the respondent, State of Hawaii, Brian Vincent, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Argument on the merits.
Good morning and aloha to both of our counsel, to those of us who joined us here at Ali'i Lani Hale, and also to those who are watching on YouTube. Counsel, are you both ready to proceed today? Ms. Chang. So Ms. Chang, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go in your argument. And Mr. Vincent, we will give you a warning with 10 minutes to go. Please proceed, Ms. Chang.
Good morning, Chief Justice Rechtenwald and Associate Justices, Deputy Public Defender Haley Chang, on behalf of Petitioner Appellant Chance Hirata. Mr. Chance Hirata was charged with one count of continuous sexual assault of a minor. The minor complainant was the niece.
Can you just put the mic a little closer, please?
Yes.
Thank you.
My apologies. The minor complainant was the niece of Mr. Hirata's longtime girlfriend. A jury trial commenced in May of 2019, and from the start of the trial, the state admitted that their case came down to the credibility of one person, the 11-year-old complainant, who will also be referred to as RKP. In closing argument, the prosecutor made multiple improper statements about the credibility of both the complainant as well as the defendant and the defendant's witnesses. The Intermediate Court of Appeals has gravely erred in affirming Mr. Hirata's conviction in two ways. First, it was error to hold that the prosecutor had not expressed personal opinions or had not improperly vouched for the credibility of the complainant in closing argument. And secondly, it was error to find that there was overwhelming evidence when evaluating the strength of the evidence against Mr. Hirata. I would first like to address the prosecutor's improper comments about the complainant's credibility. It has been well established that prosecutors must not express personal views as to the credibility of witnesses. A personal view is not just limited to when a prosecutor overtly says something to the effect of, I believe the witness is credible, or I know the witness is telling the truth. An expression of personal opinion is also when there is a statement about a witness's credibility that is made without reference to the evidence or facts supporting those statements. In other words, statements about a witness's credibility must be done with reference to the specific evidence that supports it. In Salavea, this court stated that this principle is based on the rationale that expressions of personal opinion by the prosecutor can be a form of unsworn, unchecked testimony intended to exploit the influence of the prosecutor's office. And in this case, the prosecutor's comments included stating the following: she's believable, she was brave, she tried to be brave. At the end of almost 3 hours, she couldn't be brave anymore.
Let's talk about believable first. When the prosecutor first made that comment, it came immediately after a discussion of the jury instruction, which I think refers to what extent the witness should be believed. Does that anchor this comment in any way? And didn't the comment, it seemed to be followed by then factual argument, or at least argument based on the record. How does that fit in your analytical framework?
And what we would say about that, Your Honor, is merely stating or referencing the court's jury instruction related to witness credibility does not necessarily mean that everything that follows is proper and is a proper comment on the witness's credibility. For example, we know that in Salovea and in other cases, there were instances where the prosecutor had begun their summation or referenced the instruction. For example, in Salovea, I believe the prosecutor started their closing argument by referencing this exact same jury instruction and then proceeded to state improper conclusory opinions about the credibility of the complainant, such as, she told you the truth. The CW or the complainant was credible. And the court held that those statements were improper, even when there was a reference to the jury instructions. The mere mention, I believe our position would be, that the mere mention of the jury instruction followed by improper comments is nothing more than a pretext to try to guise what the prosecutors are asking the court to find to be a proper argument.
If she had said, the prosecutor had said, the government submits that she was believable, would that have been okay or not okay?
We would again argue that that would not be okay. There are other cases where the court has interjected during closing and said, the state submits, the state submits, even without objection of defense counsel. And when you look at everything, it is still not enough to fix or remedy the improper comments and the prejudicial effect it could have on the jury. When a prosecutor, yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but while you're on this issue about comments on the testimony, I wanted to get your help in analyzing the reference to motive. Specifically, is it your understanding that when the prosecutor said that there was a motive?
Justice Wilson, I can't hear you. Could you just put the mic a little closer? I'm having a little bit of a hard time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, good. So I was asking about the comment that was made by the prosecutor about motive to lie. What's in the context of this record, did you find evidence of motive to lie other than the fact that this was a defendant? And if that was the case, that the reference to motive to lie was based on the position of the witness as being the defendant, to what extent do you contend that that was an inappropriate statement about the defendant's decision to testify?
Well, we would agree, unlike what the ICA held regarding the comments about the state's witness, we would agree with the ICA that that was clearly improper. Saying there was a motive to lie, being couched with no other evidence to support that or to correlate with that, is clearly improper and has been established through a litany of cases. And I believe specifically what the prosecutor here said, so is the defense's story believable? And again, to go back to what Justice McKenna referenced earlier, she attempted to hearken back to the same jury instruction by saying, we looked at the same factors, referencing the jury instruction about credibility. But again, just the mention of that does not do enough to alleviate the impropriety of the statement. We believe, Your Honor, that that's exactly what the state was doing in this case. She was saying that basically he is the defendant, and therefore he has been charged with a crime, so therefore he must have a motive to lie. And that was extremely prejudicial. And it also was exacerbated by the fact that she extended that argument to the rest of the defense witnesses, included his parents, et cetera.
Is it your understanding that it would be improper for, in closing argument, the prosecutor to note that a defendant that did not testify, did not come forward and give a story, or didn't come forward and tell the truth?
Absolutely. And we know that's improper.
This might be State versus Basham. So why would it be, or would it be any less improper for a statement to be made to that effect where the defendant, as in this case, decides to testify?
And we would submit that it's no less improper. And the language from Basham clearly supports that when they said that a suggestion that defendants have no reason to tell the truth, which is exactly what happened here, he is a defendant, so he had a motive to lie, impinges upon the fundamental principles of our system of justice. including the presumption of innocence, including the burden of proof upon the government, and the right to testify without penalty. Essentially, what we believe the prosecutor was doing here and what the ICA agreed was improper was commenting on his position as a defendant and therefore asking the jury to draw the conclusion that therefore he, and by extension, all of his witnesses, must have had a motive to lie.
What about the comment you referred to, the comments about the complainant being brave? Is that vouching or is that an attempt to explain her demeanor and actions in the courtroom? And does that matter?
Well, we would first submit that it is an improper comment on credibility. We would again submit that it was an improper characterization of her demeanor, especially, Your Honor, in the context of when we are discussing an 11-year-old girl. An 11-year-old girl was the critical witness in this case. And essentially what the prosecutor was doing was saying, because she got up there, because she availed herself of the questions of both prosecution and the defense, because she continued to testify despite being emotional and crying, that she was brave. And we would submit to you that bravery does not equal credibility. The prosecutor was free to highlight to the jury that she answered all of the questions.
If bravery doesn't equate credibility, then it's not a comment on her credibility. Isn't it just fair argument?
I would submit that it's improper argument, and it was designed to do something other than ask the jury to focus on the evidence and the facts that were presented in making their decision.
Wasn't she trying to explain to the jury why the complaining witness, apparently at one point reading the transcript after lengthy cross-examination, appeared to have gotten uncertain or broken down to the point where defense counsel actually said, would you like to change your testimony? And her response was, it all happened. So clearly there was a moment in the trial where, you know, again, it's very hard to tell from a cold transcript, but evidently it appeared that she had been shaken to the point where the defense lawyer asked that, you know, a few good men question. Correct. You want to change your testimony? And she said, no, it all happened. So my question is, given that context, is it why would it not be proper for the prosecutor to try to characterize what was going on in those minutes and hours of cross-examination as her being brave?
Well, I would submit that...
As opposed to being a liar.
Correct. Well, and Your Honor, I think that's what I was just about to say. We know words have power and words have meaning and words carry very heavy connotations that can have an undue influence on the jury. We agree that the prosecution was absolutely free to argue that despite defense counsel's efforts to inquire about whether she changed her story, she maintained and deliberately continued to state what happened to her. That is very different from couching and trying to present the complainant under this cloak of bravery. Essentially, I think when you look at the context and the circumstances of this entire argument, the prosecutor repeated that word and that characterization of the complainant multiple times. She started it that way. She ended it that way. She used that word brave multiple times.
Ms. Chung, aside from the use of brave, you know, didn't you raise as a point of error the fact that the prosecutor asserted that the complainant testified consistent with a child being traumatized?
Correct.
The ICA didn't address that, did they, in their opinion?
They did not.
And there wasn't any evidence that the complaining witness was traumatized presented at trial, was there?
Our position is absolutely not. In fact, the entire record in the context of the testimony that was presented, the word, I believe, trauma or traumatic or traumatizing or any delineation of that word was only used once. And that was when Dr. Bivens testified something about it can happen when a child experiences a traumatic event.
Do you think that by saying that or expressing the viewpoint that a witness testified consistent with being traumatized is injecting new evidence into the case?
That would be our position. And, you know, I know there's a whole litany of things addressing expert witnesses specific to Dr. Bivens, who was the witness in this
case. But Bivens didn't testify specifically about this particular witness because he couldn't, right? He was just testifying generally.
Correct. And he did not. And it was a conclusion that the prosecutor improperly made in her closing. And it's very prejudicial and problematic because clearly that was done, our position is, to try to garner favor or bolster what Dr. Bivens had said in a way that was not presented in evidence during any kind of testimony.
So not only was it not evidence, but also it would have probably been precluded because the after effects or the victim impact on a particular witness is precluded. And we said that in Rivera. So, I mean, can you know, aside from the bravery, it seems to me that the comment about being consistent with trauma supports your position a little bit more. But let me ask you something. I want to shift to something a little bit different. You know, the ICA said that the evidence was consistent and compelling. And then it said that the evidence that was presented by the defense witnesses were, quote, subject to impeachment for lack of opportunity to perceive. And then they used that to balance or to in their calculus to suggest that the evidence was overwhelming. You know, it strikes me that both the state's witnesses and the defense witnesses, you know, did not have an opportunity to perceive any element of the crime. So what is your position as far as the ICA's conclusion that the defense witnesses were impeachable and that the evidence was overwhelming?
Well, I think what says it all is the prosecution, by their own admission, never argued or asserted that the evidence was overwhelming. And in fact, during opening, which is part of the record, and their whole tenor of their closing argument was it came down to one witness. They never said that there was an eyewitness on their half. Clearly, the evidence is not overwhelming. And with regards to impeachment of the defense witnesses, essentially, it was clear what the defense was trying to argue, right? That there was X amount of people in this household. They were there all the time. Multiple people would have or perhaps should have seen what was going on if it in fact occurred, given the duration and the frequency with the allegations. So an improper comment that they are impeachable.
I mean, is that really impeachment or is that just commentary on evidence?
It's commentary on evidence.
Right. So, you know, when the ICA says that was impeachable, and it also strikes me again that, well, the state's witnesses, I mean, by the nature of the case, you know, they could have been impeachable.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
And to further address the second issue regarding the other things that the ICA found with relation to the strength and weakness of the evidence, they go through and delineate everything that their witnesses said. They reference that therefore, and this kind of goes back to our first point where the prosecution's argument is that they are couching all of their statements about credibility in the evidence. But really the only thing that the state witnesses ever say is, she was a happy girl. She liked going over there. And her demeanor seemed different when she allegedly reported this. So we find it puzzling that the ICA would conclude that there was overwhelming evidence in this case as one of the factors to determine whether or not this was reversible. And we find it puzzling that given the egregiousness of what was said about a motive to lie, and extending that characterization, especially what we know now about that term lie and the direction from the court on how that word is impermissible in light of State v. Austin, that they would continue to say that. And it cannot be said that this did not have a prejudicial effect and significantly impacted the defendant's right to a fair trial.
Ms. Chang, if you could be a little more explicit about your proposition that this was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, what is it in your view that the jury applying the standard and determining whether there's a reasonable possibility that the error complained of might have contributed to the conviction. What evidence would you identify that the jury might have considered were it not for this, that the evidence that the jury might have considered that would have affected their determination?
Well, I think in light of what was said at closing, and this is particularly why it was improper, was clearly the prosecution knew and centered their entire case around trying to get the jury to believe that this girl was telling the truth. Because as was previously discussed with Justice Edens, there's no eyewitnesses. There's really no corroborating evidence. It's just her word. So for the prosecution to then bolster improperly, opine improperly, and tug
I get the idea that you're saying that the prosecutorial misconduct constituted improper bolstering, but I'm trying to get to the specifics. For example, is it your position that by stating that there was a motive to lie, that somehow the jury would have taken that into consideration and applied it to the defendant's testimony?
Absolutely.
And how would that then have affected their view of the defendant's testimony, the fact that the government said that there was a motive to lie?
It would have affected it because the conclusion is that he is a liar, that everything he said about...
A liar because why?
Because he's the defendant. And beyond that, nothing more. And really, when you look at what Mr. Hirata testified to the nature of the relationship. He testified to the dynamic of the relationship. He testified that he did nothing, never had any improper sexual contact. That was really the crux and the heart of what he said. And by asserting that he lied without any basis in the evidence, clearly, even though the words did not come out of the prosecutor's mouth, the only implication is that he had a motive to lie. Subsequently, what can be taken from that? He is a liar, and therefore nothing that he testified to is believable. So if he cannot be believed, then we're left with the complaining witness who was a brave little girl and got up there and told you what happened. And that's the harm when these types of statements are made and arguments are put forth to a jury in a case, specifically when the case comes down to the credibility of witnesses.
So what arguments would be appropriate with regard to, say, the parents? So what do you see as the actual harm in light of the evidence in this case of arguing that they had a motive to lie? I mean, because their testimony was really, we didn't see anything. So really, the impeachment of, say, they're liars is, you know, what's in the bigger scheme of this trial, how did that have a significant impact?
Well, it had it there. And to answer the first question, Your Honor, there was a lot that the state could have properly argued. The prosecution could have said clearly by what was testified to at trial, the parents were not in the home with the girl 24 hours a day. They did not sleep in the same bedroom as the girl each and every night. They were not in the same room with the girl and the defendant on multiple occasions. The defendant's mother testified that she worked, I think, 3 or 4 days a week. The father admitted that although he was disabled and home most of the time, that he had taken 2 trips off island. That is proper argument. The prosecutor can clearly point to how these parents obviously would have not had every opportunity to view or observe or witness improper contact. That would have been an appropriate argument for the prosecution to make. Similarly, with the defendant's girlfriend, same argument could be made there. There was other things that she could have argued to call properly into question the credibility of the defense witnesses, rather than to just boldface say they all have a motive to lie. And it goes back to what Justice Wilson was saying, that it really does nothing more than comment on the defendant's position as the one sitting in the courtroom accused and charged of the crime.
Go ahead.
What about the CJ's second question?
I'm sorry,
his second question,
and I
which was he was aiming at.
In the greater scope of this trial, you did a very good job of explaining why this testimony is kind of, you know, they weren't watching 24 hours a day. This was all happening at night when the lights were off or that was in the bathroom. In the greater scope of things, you know, absolutely, they shouldn't have been called liars. But how would that necessarily have infected or caused the jury to go way off track and lose sight of the more important and more salient argument that you pointed out, which is that they weren't there all the time to see it.
Well, I think what is the harm of what was done here was there was never a delineation between the defendant, his witnesses, or really looking at the specifics of their testimony. The generalized comment that they had a motive to lie without any particular reference in the evidence is extremely problematic because it concludes for the jury. It doesn't ask them to consider the evidence. It doesn't ask them to take a look at what was said. It concludes improperly for the jury and takes away their fact-finding function that they are liars. And I think that's critical in this case when the defense has advanced a position that there are some issues with what happened here because this is alleged to have occurred. I mean, if you know, there's not an exact calculation of the amount of times, but I believe the testimony was that this happened almost every time she went there. She was there almost every weekend, sometimes during the week as well. So when you're talking about all of these things and there's a blanket statement by a prosecutor who's in that position and emboldened with all of the status that a prosecutor has, that this defendant and therefore all of his witnesses are liars because they're helping their son or he's been charged with a crime, it is absolutely improper in the scope of what the evidence was here when it came down to just the credibility of the witnesses.
There can be no comment at all about the interests of the witness or their possible bias.
There absolutely can be. There absolutely can be, but none of that evidence was elicited from the prosecutor.
Is there a difference, Ms. Cheng, between saying somebody has a motive to lie versus using the standard instruction in 3.09, which says, you know, in assessing credibility, you can look at the witness's interest in the case or the relationship between the parties? That's fair game to argue, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's the thing is we are not saying that there is never a opportunity or that it would always be improper for the prosecution, even when it comes to familial relationships or a mom, a dad, a girlfriend, a wife, to make a comment or argue that there were factors or some interest in the outcome of the case. But what was specifically said here in the context of everything was improper.
So the defense attorney can get up there and say to this, you saw her, she's a liar. And the prosecutor said, well, there are factors for you to consider. So that's the delineation you're asking for, right? The defense attorney can get up there and call anybody he or she wants a liar. But the prosecutor just, as you say, there are factors that you need to consider. How does that affect a jury?
Well,
the jury then thinks the prosecutor doesn't exactly believe the complaining witness either.
But, Your Honor, I would submit that we're not advocating for a standard that delineates what specifically is proper for a defense attorney. What I will say, though, is that there are factors.
So do you think it was improper? It would be improper for a defense attorney also to stand up and call somebody a liar?
I think the use of the word lie and liar, there is clear case law about the appropriateness.
Yes, I know
of
what you're
word.
Talking about.
I believe, though, as the case law has stated, for a defense attorney to get up there and just blanket make a statement that somebody lied without referencing the evidence or referencing the testimony that was presented would be objectionable. And I would expect I would not be surprised if the court sustained an objection by a prosecutor on that ground. But that does not free the prosecution from doing exactly what this court has held time and time again that they must do, which is avoid the use of those words. And no matter what, not make improper arguments or statements or comments about the credibility of a witness without reaching back and pointing specifically to the evidence. I do see that I'm out of time. If I may reserve the rest for my rebuttal.
You may.
Thank you.
We'll hear from Mr. Benson. Thank you, Ms. Cheng. Mr. Vincent, yeah, if you could bring the mic up.
Yeah, it's hard to speak through these masks. Good morning. I think the first thing I should start with is that at no time was the prosecutor's argument objected to at trial. And I'm just wondering how plain error standard comes into the review of this issue. It seems to me that unless the alleged misconduct affected the fundamental fairness of the trial, it should be not noticed. I would acknowledge right from the very beginning that the DPA's comment that they have a motive to lie was improper to the extent that it alleged that the defendant himself had a motive to lie because he was a defendant. So to the extent that the jury would have understood that kind of argument, it was incorrect. I would point out that the deputy prosecuting attorney spent probably 80, 90% of the oral argument arguing the credibility of the complaining witness based on the standard jury instruction that was read to the jurors before oral argument, before closing argument began, right? And so I would submit that the DPA's arguments with respect to the complaining witness's credibility were proper. It's probably better to say, I submit that she's not telling the truth, so forth, okay? These things slip out sometimes, and I don't think that it's ever going to be able to entirely prevent prosecutors from saying that from time to time, because they're advocates. We're advocates. We're all advocates.
Well, thank you for focusing on, I guess, the degree to which this was harmless error. I mean, you have what may well be a statement about the defendant's lack of credibility just because the defendant testified, as you inferred. So why wouldn't that be something that the jury rightfully would consider? I mean, you have the prosecutor saying you can consider the fact that by virtue of trying to not be convicted, this defendant has told you a false story. I mean, that's might be considered a powerful statement, right? Certainly, I would think that it's a straightforward proposition that coming from the prosecutor, a jury being told they could consider that somebody testifying as a defendant is likely not telling the truth because they're trying to, avoid conviction. So why wouldn't that mean that we have reached the point where a juror could reasonably have considered that and therefore the error was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
I think that given the context of the statement and given the DPA's lengthy discussion of the complaining witness's credibility, I strongly suspect that the deputy prosecuting attorney, what they really meant is that if you believe the complaining witness's story that he did it, if you believe the defendant actually committed these things, then he would have a motive to not tell the truth. But of course, the flip side of that is if the defendant did not do those things, then he would have a strong motive to tell the truth. And I think the mistake of the DPA in this case was not stating both sides. Okay, but I think that
It's the most important witness for the defense, right? The defendant is the most important witness.
That's correct.
And was there anybody else there to see what happened?
No, there was just the complaining witness and the defendant.
So if you have the most important witness for the defense being characterized, presumably rightfully so, by the government, characterized as somebody you can consider as not telling the truth because they're just trying to avoid being convicted, wouldn't that be a potentially persuasive fact for the jury that, hey, this is the person accused of the crime and we can consider that he's not telling the truth because he would lie to protect himself?
We believe that in the context that it was said, it was not considered for the jury in that respect.
Well, I appreciate the context concept, and to some extent that gets us focused on the question. In other words, was there other independent evidence? It seems like you had the testimony of Dr. Bivens, but when you compare this, for example, to the like the Conroy case with press, in terms of harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, that was a case in which you had some pretty physical evidence of a complaining witness being beaten and the fact that there was an error made by virtue of not allowing certain evidence to be, well, in any case, harmless error was found there, was not found there, because in that case, the decision that was made with respect to the error of the government was not considered to be harmless, because even though there was independent evidence of injury, since it was just a swearing match, in that case, the court found there wasn't harmless error.
Well, it is true. This is not a case like Austin where you had DNA evidence. Okay. You do have two people whose version of the events is diametrically opposed. But both the deputy prosecuting attorney and the defense counsel concentrated on the complaining witness's testimony. When the defendant's turn to have closing argument came, he spent a great part of his time, probably a majority of his time, attacking the complaining witness's credibility rather than trying to bolster the defendant's credibility.
Mr. Vincent, can I ask you a question about the standard jury instructions? And those are the standard instructions that were given in this case, specifically 3.15 and 3.09. Now, 3.15 is when a defendant testifies he's to be treated, his credibility is to be assessed in the same way as other witnesses. So that directs you to 3.09. One of the provisions in 3.09 in assessing the credibility of a witness is their interest, if any, in the result of the case. What is a testifying defendant's interest in the result of the case? It's avoiding conviction.
Well, yeah, if he did it, it's to avoid conviction. Well, I mean, it's avoiding conviction, period, I guess. Yes, but
I mean, so even, you know, let's put aside even any variance of the prosecution saying, you know, the defendant had a motive to lie, or had an interest in the result of the case. It strikes me, or can you help me? Can you explain how 3.09 itself is not a generic comment that a defendant's testimony is unworthy of belief based on the defendant being the defendant, the status?
I think it could be interpreted as a generic comment to some extent.
So if interest, if any, in the result of the case, you know, a jury's back there, they hear the judge read the instruction, the jury has the instructions backstage. The prosecutors, you have to argue that, but they might see, wow, the interest in the result of the case, that's clearly not being convicted. And doesn't that relate to the presumption of innocence, the burden of proof, the right to a fair trial? Doesn't it undermine and undercut the right to testify or not testify, that standard instruction? Tell me how it doesn't.
Well, I didn't come here today prepared to discuss whether the standard jury instructions were well stated or correctly.
But isn't the motive to lie comment at least underpinned when the deputy prosecutor argued that, when she set out the factors, you know, the interest in the result of the case? That's essentially what they were getting at.
I guess a more appropriate jury instruction would be that if the defendant has committed the crime, then he would have a motive to lie about having committed the crime. But if he did not commit the crime, then he would, on the inverse side, have a strong motivation.
But I mean, that's
to tell the truth.
That's circling around to what the jury's job to do is determine that or not.
And that's why the jury is told from the very get go that they're there to determine all the.
I mean, how is the interest in the result of the case not directly related to the status of the defendant?
I think it's very hard. It can be hard for jurors to separate the fact that this person is on trial, you know, somebody we should believe. But they have been instructed that they're to treat the witness like any other witness. So, and I think that the verdict in this case was a result of discussion of the complaining witness's credibility rather than the defendant's credibility in the long run.
Well, I mean, that's perhaps an interpretation later in you know, reading transcripts. But they seem to go hand in hand. The credibility of one witness when it's on a two credibility case. I mean, if one witness is credible, then the other isn't. So I don't see how you can, you know, split them. I mean, it seems like it's the same argument. You know, if one witness is credible, then the other witness isn't. But let me ask you this, and sorry, I want to just shift another area. I want to ask you this, the traumatized question that I asked, you know, Ms. Chang. The ICA didn't address that, right? The consistent with the child who's traumatized comment by the prosecutor.
Yeah, that was not raised at trial, and it was also not raised in the opening brief, the ICA, but...
I thought it was a point of error in the opening brief.
If I remember correctly, I don't think it was that was pointed to as that particular statement was pointed to as a point of error.
Okay, well,
that may be even correct.
Okay, let's say it was. Can you try to justify, to in my mind, how a prosecutor opining about a witness's testimony being consistent with being traumatized is not does not impact the right to a fair trial. If not only injecting new evidence and prejudicial evidence, how that comment didn't infect this trial?
Well, I think there was some evidence that she was traumatized. I believe that the officer that she admitted originally was brought to right after she'd called the sex offense hotline at Don Kailua Police Station. He testified that she was subdued and didn't appear happy and cheerful like a normal child would be. I think at some point during the trial, I think she had some sort of emotional, I don't know if she cried or I think the jury, I was aware to the jury that there was some kind of trauma. And I think everybody's common sense understanding was that it's very traumatic accusing your uncle
But is it different when the prosecutor looks the jury in the eye and says, hey, look, she just testified. That testimony is consistent with a child who's being traumatized. That's a little bit different, don't you think?
Well, I mean, the jurors are instructed that they're not supposed to consider the attorney's statements as evidence. And they're free to make up their own mind as to whether or not what they've seen or what they've heard is consistent with trauma.
Okay.
Mr. Vincent, Dr. Bivens testified reasons children don't disclose is shame and embarrassment talking about it. Isn't a reasonable inference from that evidence to argue that this is a traumatic experience for the witness?
Your Honor. And the fact that she waited for such a long period of time before reporting it indicates that she was afraid, working through whether she wanted to report it or not.
Well, in any event, isn't it the jury's determination on whether indeed a witness has been traumatized? I mean, the DPA pretty much said, hey, that's consistent with trauma, the way she testified.
Yeah, I don't I think it was, I just submit that it was argument and the jury regarded it as such.
If I could get back to beyond the standard of whether these, you could say beyond a reasonable doubt, this error affected the jury's verdict. Can you help me, Mr. Vincent, with the Williams case? Because wouldn't the Williams case apply here? That's where another sexual assault case, a prosecutorial misconduct, there was a finding of error in admitting a statement of evidence. But when the court determined whether this sexual assault case involved error that was harmless or not, it found that because it was a swearing match between the child witness and the defendant, that under these circumstances it wouldn't be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Why wouldn't that control in this case, where similarly you don't have really evidence other than the complaining witness and the defendant?
Well, again, as I stated in the beginning of my argument, this was never objected to at trial, and I think that it gives you some indication that how it was taken by the people who were present at the trial. It certainly wasn't considered as serious as I think the defendant now considers it on appeal.
Okay, so it's your evaluation about how serious a violation it is to comment on the defendant's decision to testify, in the sense of saying that they have a motive to not tell the truth by virtue of the fact that they're the defendant.
Yeah. The word, when they said they have a motive to lie, it's not clear necessarily that it's applying just to the defendant. Certainly his family had a motive to lie. And they didn't see anything. So they would have had a motive to say something other, simply because they have a personal family or financial stake in making sure that he doesn't go to jail, right?
How far do you think you can, if that argument can go before it's argumentative? For example, do you think that it would be appropriate for a defense counsel to tell the jury that police officer is lying because it's their job to help the prosecution?
I think it's objectionable for them to say that. I mean, it's objectionable, but
because there's a strong relationship there, right? You have a relationship. Now, maybe you're misrepresenting the nature of the job by saying that a police officer's job is to lie. I mean, that maybe is argumentative, but at the same time, to say that, you know, the role of a mother or a father is to lie on behalf of their child, it just seems like in some ways it'd be similar. But is one improper and the other not?
I mean, for example, my guess is that defendants frequently argue that the officers want to solve the case, and so they point at somebody, you know. It's a common argument, and I don't know if it's ever upheld as being fairly prejudicial or not. But certainly, family members have some sort of interest in making sure, and that their family member doesn't go to jail.
On a non-family member, when we talk about a motive to lie for a testifying defendant, it seems like it would always relate to the status of the defendant. Can you give us an example of a non-generic argument where a testifying defendant's motive to lie would relate to something other than status?
I thought there was one case that I read. I don't know if it was Basham. It was where there was an argument that he had.
Well, Basham didn't testify, and he made statements to the police.
Yeah,
and then there was a motive to lie comment there. But right. For a testifying defendant, I mean, it just seems like any comment about motive to lie just relates only to the status. I'm trying to think of a situation where it wouldn't. There'd be a non-generic, you know, argument. And I'm just wondering if you happen to think of any.
Well, there might be a situation where somebody, it's an embarrassing situation. It's not a crime, but it's an embarrassing situation, but they would have a motive.
Yeah, like maybe covering up, you know, something else. But that would be, you know, a non-element, almost a tangential aspect of the case. I mean, you'd, right? I mean, it wouldn't have to do with any element, say. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to be a side aspect of the case, that motive to lie.
Mr. Right? Vincent, what would be your assessment of the impact on the truth-finding function of the jury if there could be no examination of whether the defendant's testimony might be affected by his or her self-interest in the outcome of the case?
Well, you know, our Anglo-American system of justice is a system of advocacy, vigorous advocacy on both sides. And there has to be some kind of, a leeway for striking hard blows, as they say, you know, fair blows, but hard. And I think in this case, and I think in general, you should not, you should not limit to a prosecutor just saying the most innocuous, saying things in the most innocuous way that they possibly can say that. I mean, the reality is that defense attorneys, you know, they want to argue to the juror that, you know, I'm vigorously advocating for my client because I believe he's not guilty. Okay. The prosecutor should have a certain amount of leeway to say that I'm advocating for conviction because I believe my complainant is telling the truth.
I'm sorry, you're saying that the defense attorney could make such an argument and the prosecutor could make such an argument? I'm a little confused now.
Well, I think that defense attorneys are going to be subtly or directly or indirectly trying to suggest to the jury that I believe my
defense. Right, but it's also improper for a defense attorney to say that, right?
I
believe my client.
I'm not aware of any cases where
Rule 3.4 of the Rules of Professional Conduct, subsection G, a lawyer shall not in trial state a personal opinion as to the justness of a cause, the credibility of a witness, the culpability of a civil litigant, or the guilt or innocence of an accused.
You should not,
so what we're talking about,
you should not directly state those kind of things, but to the average, I think to the average person, advocates.
I understand. The lawyers try to imbue their belief in their client's case. You know, I mean, but the rules of professional conduct prohibit both the prosecutor and a defense attorney, or even a civil lawyer, from personally stating a belief as to credibility or guilt or innocence.
They certainly don't.
And it appears that the prosecutor actually, we say that, you know, for the prosecutor, there's a higher standard. And even if the prosecutor doesn't say, I believe this complaining witness because of the position, you can't make statements, generic statements, about credibility. I mean, isn't that what we're talking about here?
Ultimately, attorney's zealousness for his client, and conversely, the prosecutor's zealousness for their complaining witness is going to have some impact on the jury.
I'm sorry, I can't hear and understand you.
Sorry. I believe that it just as a matter of reality, an advocate's appearance of zealousness for their client is going to have some impact on the jurors.
Oh, absolutely. But it's the appearance. But the rules say you can't specifically say things.
But it's not just the rules. I mean, this is a proposition that has to do with the right to a fair trial. How far can you go, Mr. Vincent?
Well, that's
in other words, after you tell the jury, you know, I really believe my client's testimony, you say, and you know, I've had lots of cases. I only take cases where my clients are telling the truth. How far can you go in explaining why the jury should believe because you believe? How far can you go in telling the jury that they should give credibility to you because of the strength of your belief? Maybe you can say, you know, I know the family very well. This defendant would never say such a thing. I mean, this witness would never say such a thing, and defense counsel, I assume, could get up and talk about the same thing about their awareness of the background of the individual. I mean, it seems straightforward that, for one thing, it's bringing evidence into the case during this period when evidence isn't supposed to be presented. If during closing argument or rebuttal, you have the prosecutor say, you know, I really believe my client or, you know, my the victim in this case.
Mr. Vincent, I may have misunderstood what you said, but I don't think you ever advocated that kind of language. Did you? You were just talking about
advocated
being a zealous advocate.
That's right. That's correct. I just think that how many times people object to the defense counsel, to the opposing party, various things like that, give to the prior of fact, the appearance that, okay, he's being zealous. He really believes his side's story. And that's all I was suggesting, Your Honor.
And anything else, Mr. Vincent, you want to bring to the attention of the court?
No, that's it. I'm ready to say right.
Further questions? Thank you for your argument. We'll hear the rebuttal from Ms. Chang.
I just have a few closing remarks, and I wanted to just briefly address some of the dialogue regarding vigorous advocacy, and if the state cannot do something, therefore, should it mean the defense cannot also? And you know, I think when we're dealing with things like this, the cases are very fact specific. What was said, the details of what was said does matter. But as Mr. Vincent advocated, there does need to be vigorous advocacy on both sides. Nobody is saying that there shouldn't be. But in this situation, we take issue with the characterization that what the prosecutor in this case said was innocuous, that she just spit it out, sort of like off the cuff. The record reveals, and taking a close look at the prosecutor's closing argument, that it was planned, it was deliberate, it was sequential, it was organized, it was not an innocuous comment. And to refer back to what I attempted to argue in response to Justice Nakayama's inquiry about, is it okay if a defense attorney gets up there and says this, but not okay for the state? What we do know is that the prosecutors are held to a different standard when it comes to these types of issues because of the special role that they have.
I have a specific question. Did Dr. Bivens testify that minor victims of sexual abuse will tend to break down on the stand when their credibility is questioned because of the trauma?
I don't know if that's specifically what he said, but I will acknowledge that he did talk about the emotional response.
Emotional response when? On the stand? Did he talk about
specifically on the stand? He specifically talked about and was asked about and testified to at the time of disclosure And the ongoing nature of the disclosures.
Right. So the argument, but the argument was, and at the end of almost 3 hours, she couldn't be brave anymore. And you saw her when she got emotional. She broke down when the defense attorney continued to question her credibility and if she was making this up. And her answer to you was, this really happened. It's consistent with a child who is traumatized. So you're indicating there was no expert evidence in the record that this happens when a child is traumatized on the stand.
Absolutely. And it was an improper.
So how is this not the prosecutor providing evidence during closing argument?
We would submit that it was. It was improper. It was an improper conclusion. And it was an extension of something that was not testified to, but that I believe at best was alluded to, but it was interjecting evidence that was improper. And just in closing, we have highlighted, and this court has said multiple times, that the prosecutor does have a different role and a special one. They are imbued with credibility, with some sense of authority, and that is why what they say does matter. How they say it matters. There has to be limitations on the lengths that they can go when they are advocating their position, and it absolutely can, and in this case does, extend beyond zealous advocacy for their office. So we would ask this court to—
What is the appropriate argument with regard to the defendant's, if any, with regard to the defendant's interest in the outcome of the case? Because that is the jury instruction. The defendant's testimony should be considered like anyone else's, and then the witness interest, if any, in the result of the case. So what is appropriate? In your view?
I think there's a lot of issues that Justice Edens brought up with the potential concerns regarding that jury instruction and whether there can be a proper argument that meaningfully points to an interest in the outcome of the case that would not comment on the position of the defendant. There are situations, there are none here present in this case, where there might have been an interest in the case that are not directly related to just the position as the defendant. And I think if I had to speculate, that's the types of things that the jury instruction is asking the jury to consider. It cannot be just because he is the defendant in the case.
How about with regard to the family members? Is it appropriate argument to say they're worried about their son or they're worried about their boyfriend. They don't want to see him go to jail. And that could have an impact on their testimony. Not that they're liars, but it could affect their testimony. Appropriate or not?
And we've seen that happen. I'm sure the court has read transcripts where the prosecutor has cross-examined a defense witness and said, you love him, you care about him, you don't want to see anything bad happen to him. And in this case, that was actually done and then sua sponte struck by the court because there was a finding or a ruling that that may be improper comment on penalty or punishment. I think if there can be, without getting into exact questions, which I'm a little bit uncomfortable doing, but I do believe that if the prosecution, through appropriate questioning, can articulate specifics where a family member has perhaps indicated that they will be dishonest because they don't want somebody to get into trouble, something like that, that is a specific instance that can be referenced in an argument and ties back to the evidence, which is, again, the crux of everything here. It needs to be tied back to the evidence, and that obviously was not done here.
So the kind of question like, you love your son or you love your boyfriend, you don't want to see anything bad happen to them, that would be objectionable, right? Under your theory, unless there was some evidence that they had previously said, hey, I'll lie for my family if anything ever happens to them.
No, I think the question, if do you love your son, I think can be answered. What I think is improper, though, is for then the prosecution to supplant its conclusion about what a response to that might automatically mean. And that is an automatic comment on there's no good reason for them to say anything.
So the prosecutor, you're saying that the prosecutor can't ask the parent, would you lie for your son? Are you, you're not saying that, are you?
No, I'm not saying
okay.
that.
Okay.
I'm not saying that's that, fine. And that's not
because the problem. Then that would be the crux, as you call it, to the final argument of saying he's, you said, you know, you saw what he said, he would lie for his son, or he wouldn't lie for his son, or whatever. Okay.
Well, in this case, I think the girlfriend, the question was, you don't want to see anything bad happen to him, right? And her answer was no. Now, that I don't think that was objected to. I'm not sure the part that you're talking about, but in this, at least the transcript I saw, that was a testimony. So fair, that's, it's not fair argument to say that that witness had a motive to lie.
If I recall, Your Honor, from what I recollect from the record, I do believe that question and the response was struck
eventually
sua sponte by the court. So that would not have been appropriate for the jury to consider. So our position would be that in any event, this jury, given the nature of the evidence, could not have used that, or the prosecution could not have in any way appropriately argued that as a connection to their statement about a motive to lie.
Very well. Thank you. Anything further for the court?
No, Your Honor. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for both of our attorneys today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Eku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'oku ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolo kolo ke ke hanohano o kamoku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.